some sort of mythological question which was an ideological. The ideology has to do with various elements. We are very much tuned in our own world. Sensitivity to the ongoing battle that we've had, going back for a century and a half or longer, with the world of biblical criticism. That Chosotenu is totally off the screen. And that has ramifications in a couple of directions. In one sense, fully understood, particularly many of the tendencies of people who are in that field are very aggressive and very negative. And the negativism and the aggression is even the Zvam Shem Chulun, they love ripping Homer apart also. This goes back to the late 18th century, when Booth's Prolegomena with regard to Homer appeared. And gained ground, of course, subsequent to that. And isn't it very much a problem? It has to do with the source and nature of communication. Historically, there's not been total correlation between one's faith in revelation and one's perception of Kisvei Kedish. Which I mean in two respects. Number one, conceivably people who are purely secular in their orientation could arrive at the conclusion that this is a genuine original text. If they're secular, they can't think of having a divine source, but they will agree that the single author, etc. Now, there are people who believe in revelation, but who think that speak with some measure of disdain about Nevi'im as being secretaries, or Moshe Rabbeinu as a secretary. They think in terms of inspiration. Kovach, for instance, in England, was a liberal clergy, pushed that kind of attitude, and you find in certain reforms, some of the conservatives of today's world. There's an absolute correlation, but there is a large measure of correlation between the two. And for us, of course, the source of the text, the integrity of the text, is the Aleph base. Now that need not preclude making use of some tools of criticism in a different sense. Criticism does not need to mean, and the original Greek sense of the term did not mean, sitting in judgment on the text, deciding whether it's a piece or a composite. Christian meant discerning what's in the text. Kvinein in Greek has to do with Halachas and Shabbos, Beira, Barakid. That's Kvinein. And here there's much which could be discerned, which one could make the tools of literary criticism out of a world of Emunah. It requires the depth of Yiras Shemayim and the sensitivity to the tools of literary criticism, but something certainly is possible. And there are people who've done this kind of work, in a sense shying away from some of the historical issues, which may be more problematic without the critical elements, and focusing on substantive content, which has to do with the content, the themes, shows has to do with form. Russian Makwah, Russian Behodo, speak of power, beauty, deal with this, with the, let's say again, the content and the aesthetic elements. That I can think is perfectly legitimate, provided that it's done, of course, with proper care and proper sensitivity. Is that where a person should be starting? A person has much exposure to Tanakh in a serious way? Probably not. But one could do much worse than do some of the works, Meir Weiss, for instance. I don't know if you know, and there's another book, I forget the name of the other book. One fellow who's written in this vein. There's some other people who are on the margin, whom kind of Robert Alter, done work in this area as well. And it's become, in more recent years, much more popular, as we have a growing population of people who are Shem Torah Mitzvahs, serious learning Tanakh, had some serious literary training. First lecture on this in 1962, at the time there were very few people around who were aware of these things, except for Nechama Leibowitz. She was very, very keen on this. The first time that I went to see her in 1962 at the school, I was there alone, and my wife was back in the States. I had time to go visit all kinds of different people. And I went and spent several hours at her home. At 1 o'clock in the morning, we ended up discussing Helen Gardens, the business of criticism. But the question of form and substance, and where the criticism comes up, is how to ask for precise integrity of the text. The 19th century of literary, biblical criticism began to take shape. Although it had gone back earlier, to a great extent, Spinoza was regarded as being the father of it, and other people of his late 17th century. But some of the work that was done by people who were most rabid in their criticism, not necessarily of our world, but of the Christian world, had to do with other matters entirely. So there was a Milman who wrote a book in 1839 in which the rest of our collection didn't deal with the integrity of the text, but dealt with the text itself. And he said, why did the Jewish woman make such a tumult about Abraham? Abraham said it was some Arab sheik, and Yaakov was a scheming traitor, etc., etc. And he doesn't have a critique to make about Christian apostles, and Judaism and Christianity didn't make any difference. On the face of it, he didn't tear apart one pasuk or one sefer, but he was engaged in what he would have thought was demythologization, which is much more than that, was denigration. And here you come across an issue which is very critical in our world today, including by people who define themselves as being from people. How do we portray, how do we conceive, how do we understand central figures which appear in Tanakh, or the events on some scale, values, majesty, grandeur, depth, density. And you have some people who diminish everything. They think of the others, they think of Levim, pretty much like themselves, maybe a professor sitting in some chair somewhere and holding forth. This is thus inconceivable. We have a sense of obviously in Amakoba, in a sense, nourished, nurtured by decades of being steeped in Chazal and Midrashim, of what and who Adelaidim were all about. A certain sense of the development of Jewish history, a sense of the interaction, the interface of Hashgacha, a human initiative. And this becomes a maybe more critical issue, a question which they think maybe is too much of a hot potato to touch, the question of the integrity of the text. Now here you find essentially three groups, three attitudes lined up. Those who demean, diminish everything, equivalent of late Strachey's treatment of Victorians, debunking everything, and to the extent that they've been exposed to the opposite tendency, namely to take central figures and spiritualize them, etherealize them out of recognition, they feel the need to say these are human people, normal people, normal weaknesses, normal flaws, etc. The other extreme, you have those who deny any human aspect, any human emotion, any trace weakness at any point. We got an instant mention of Tanakh involving the central figures, or which has to do with personality and how they regard it. And this, from a certain point of view, is posed a dual problem. One problem is what it does to the people. And you can relate to certain ways that Avraham Avinu and Sarah and their interaction. If you ascribe to them some human elements and human aspirations, and perhaps lose much of that content if you don't. Then the question of the Akedah, the whole literature of the Akedah. I remember from my own youth, but subsequently I had words with someone about this issue here. The Rambam speaks to Akedah as a Nisoy. Pasuk speaks to Nisoy, but give this to Savoram. And what did the Baal HaMus do? Nisoy? For you, me, it's Nisoy. For Avraham, it's kind of kind. What is it to lose a son? Someone hits you a Shemaim, you get to see with the Ben Shalayim. You've been told to buy an ice cream, you've been told to sacrifice the son. And they regarded it as a religious and theological need to totally empty Avraham of any paternal content, any emotion. If you deal with Avraham as a father, Avraham as a husband, Avraham as a human being, you have one kind of relationship to him as a person. If you have a relation, and then you understand the Akedah, as Baal HaMus Midrashim understood it. He cried and he questioned and he groped and he grappled. Oh, within the context of Amunah. But he had questions. Yesterday he told me like this, then he told me like this. And then he speak of tears rolling down his eyes and extinguishing the Aish, etc., etc. But the issue is one which goes far beyond that. Why do these people insist on emptying the others, or Moshe Rabbeinu, or anyone else, of human emotion? Because it's a combination of two premises. The first premise is that these people are perfect. They need to be thought of being perfect. Second is that having emotions is imperfect. Emotions for the weak. Strong people, if they're Hashem, Bali Amune, don't have emotions. Not just the compulsion of Ben Shalom, but emotions in general. That's for weak people, for the average person. But there is such a school, and the Bala Musa in particular are fully representative of it. If you look at still one example, Bakhoz Khan Vakha, who recruited us many years ago about the Midrash of Saber Bracious. And of course Midrash you can find every, almost everything you're looking for. And he went through the Midrash selectively. And wherever he found etherealization, the motivation, it's never one of envy, of conflict, of nothing which ordinary people fight on or argue about. But always something, a dakus, something so rarefied that you and I would even understand what inconceivable would perceive it, as the same way it was all about. Now, between these two extremes, there's a position which I fully identified. Recognizing that you're dealing certainly with great people, not people just like you and me, but with great people, great persons. And part of the greatness is the being persons, and that they're greater for being human than if they were malachim. Malachim meshim is enough for them. You want the great people. Then you tread a fine line, both in terms of the general conception and in terms of the understanding of particular events, interactions, psukim. Depending on your perception. Now some of these issues are old. To read Rashi and Bereshis and Ramban and Bereshis is very, very different. Sometimes a single pasuk. How do you understand when Rachel's plea to Yaakov, "Tani bani vayi meisanech," and his response to it? So Rashi has it all. Techa fensta. She doesn't want to miss the mitzvah of being happening to raise Klal Yisrael. That she's worried about. Her sister already took six. What's going to be left for her? Nothing. Now, Ramban understands that this is a desperate plea of an anxious young woman, partly a petulant young woman, as he describes. And he understands the interaction at that level. Similarly, we've got to many other instances as well. And yes, rather than Tanakh, I am of the school of the Ramban. But I wrote some years back that the stock was not very high in the yeshiva world today. And it isn't. But that's a fundamental issue. The fellow who learned here, which is named a little book called Reaching for Relevance. His name escapes me momentarily. It focuses on Sefer Bereishis and these issues. These are critical issues of Emunas V'Deis. No less significant from the saying of Tanakh than the question of the textual integrity. And in some sense, a person who learns Tanakh has to be aware of these issues, take a position without the general matter, and help interpret Parshas Net through that. This, of course, has to do with the narrative parts of Tanakh, particularly the dramatic narrative. The historical element, historical narrative, is, of course, a part of a different kind. One of the issues which you have to ask yourself is learning Tanakh, but what do you want to focus? I come from Chutz Taretz. Which I mean, there the focus was on ethical, theological, machshava elements, with the understanding, the psychological system, the understanding of those other parts of the Tanakh, also with very much with an eye to what are the ethical content, theological content we were with here. There was not very much emphasis placed on the study of the historical parts of Tanakh, quietly. Which meant in part, of course, that the focus overwhelmingly was on Nevi'im Achrim and Ksuvim, apart from Chumash, of course, and much less on Nevi'im Hashem. And as it's clear, for obvious reasons, particularly within the Tilumi community, which, within which the resurgence, the renaissance, the study of Tanakh has been most impressive. Charedim didn't care for Tanakh before, they don't care for it now, by and large, significant exceptions. With the Tilumi community, much of Tanakh and interest in Tanakh is fueled by the Shivat Zion, that could be a reason for learning of Yerushalayim, a reason for learning of Yerushalayim and Nechemia. These are the areas I like to focus on. I think it's disproportionately so, but this attracts people here, people with whom I'm very good personal relationships and whom I admire and stuff their work. But I think the percentage is skewed. Then there's a question of how you want to learn, the actual learning part, the attitudes you bring to what you're doing. And here are the two issues particularly. One, you learn pasuk by pasuk. Or do you learn without seeing a picture, a concept, a day, a period, etc.? Roughly speaking, if I can draw an analogy for our learning in Gemara, we learn Tanakh without the Pekiyas or Te'iyum. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but that's the general thing. And that has to do also to an allied question, and this is, what are the tools that you use? Parshanut, classical Parshanut, Rashi, Radak, etc. Then you read the pasuk after pasuk, and you want to turn it over there. Incorporate much of the Midrashim in the same manner, to the extent the Midrashim are Parshanim. They're not always Parshanim, much more than that, but to the extent. And, or you learn Tanakh as in many ways you would study some novels, some drama, or the opus, the whole work of a dramatist, looking for themes and personalities, etc., etc. There's something to be said for both. There's little to be said for those, including people, from people, who think that the Midrashim are good for Torahs and not for anything else, and who see themselves as being guided by the tools of literary criticism and nothing but that. Midrashim are an enormously rich world, and rich in many respects. Much of what's in Midrashim was not intended as just interpretive exposition. Obviously, many people are taken out of context. And you simply as a peg which dang one's message. But much of the Midrashim indeed is interpreted. I mentioned before about Quintus Sefer Bereishis in Midrashim. Of course, he found there what he wanted to find. Almost anybody could find what he wanted to find. Midrashim veer sometimes more in the direction of serialization, ascribing perfection to the characters, even where the, on the face of it, Pshat Pesukim does not indicate that. The same token, they include statements which go in the opposite direction, which ascribe negative elements which you and I would never think of. The thought of it wouldn't dare express it. Would it occur to anyone to suggest on his own, the Pesuk says that Yosef came home and asked him, he came home to have sexual relations with the boss's wife? Mind boggling. Would it occur to us to think Parsha Shechem, Parsha of Dina, that she had to be dragged out of there by force because she wanted to stay there like Patty Hearst?
Yeah.
Would it occur to us to suggest that Yaakov in his home, he had to maintain silence for close to for over a generation because he's afraid that if he was to be critical in any way of his sons, they would leave him and won't join Esau? All this we found in Chazal, and much more. But Chazal had this keen sense of seeing the interplay of greatness and humanity, and seeing that these two complement each other and don't undermine each other. That is very important to maintain. And methodologically speaking, to use those tools, the leading Pashanim, tools of Midrashim, alongside with tools of contemporary criticism. But it's not a simple matter. It's a question to ask someone how to study chemistry. The fundamental attitudinal issues. And it's, there have been all kinds of exchanges at times vituperative around some of these issues. Some of the people, I think, have gone overboard in the direction of the humanization, identified with the Chalitetz of what we are, Raishir. And they've had, I say some, not all, but there have been some sharp discussions between them and some of the Microsoft people who are offered to have a different study of Tanakh. And that's the glass.
One of these articles in Leaves of Faith mentions that two pole stars of our Hashkafa are the Rav and Rav Kook. Could you explain in what ways you see Rav Kook as a pole star for Hashkafa in our community?
Rav Kook has had enormous influence, certainly in this country. In America, Rav Kook's influence was less readily felt. One thing, and maybe now he's been translated too, maybe he's been translated, but it's difficult to read. And yes, in this highfalutin language, your head begins to swim, and some people just find it difficult to absorb that.
Who?
Linguistically.
Who?
Instead of Rav Kook's writing, he would absorb. Some people find it difficult to absorb emotionally. T. E. Yule once wrote at the beginning of the 20th century, some people just can't stand Swinburne. And some people can't stand Rav Kook for that reason. And there are elements in his work which is difficult to appreciate, although it's highly varied. Maybe people find him excessively optimistic, etc. No one questions, though, that he was a great and original thinker. In many respects, very radical. Much more radical than Lavov. Much more radical. He entertains. And it's not for naught that people of Microsoft have sat close to 30 years and his writings wouldn't let them be published. They literally hid them. But a man of great, of enormous spirituality, great human warmth, and sweep. In the world of the Atilumi community, I don't think there's anyone else who's done as much as he did for lighting a fire, reviving Emunah, reviving interest. And even if one finds some of his pronouncements questionable, one straight to the other, I think his influence has been profound, and rightly so. One of my sons spoke not long ago about the context of Zionism. One of the things that he mentioned was that the attitude which Lvov developed were very good, very sound for helping to run the state. They could not have gotten the state off the ground. And McCook did. He inspired a great many people to make great personal sacrifice. And he communicated a vision which challenged and interested. And that respect of what's been enormous. There's been a shift in the winds here. The last decade or so, his influence is on the way, the Lord's influence is on the rise. But that is part of it for reasons which we are not ought to be too happy about. Part of it has to do with greater focused individualism and more self-centered mindset in many, many quarters. And that's something we want to be excited about.
I'd like to ask two questions that are connected. One, I've heard and seen a lot of people talking about the Rav as a neo-Kantian, and I wanted to know what the Rav thinks of that. And the second thing, I understand the Lichtenstein's approach as very different, as very much more complex and without any necessarily not any autonomous rational system as far as philosophy of halacha or halachic philosophy.
The first question, I don't think it's one of the recent people described it as a new Kantian. That was described a long time ago. And in two respects, the person used neo-Kantian authors to someone we felt close, not only personally, but so in terms of what they wrote. Secondly, it was close to many of the ideas. I think that goes without saying. I don't know enough about neo-Kantianism to say some of the names, but I can't tell you that in any level, a master of the text or of the attitudes. Part of it had to do with the earlier orientation, his interest and his admiration for mathematics, physics, etc., for that kind of systematic scientific thought. That probably has its roots in the kind of rigor that Kant brought to philosophy. I say again, I can't think of a position without that. About the same question that you raise, I'm not sure exactly what you mean, but I would say the following. I think that Love probably spoke on many occasions with great vigor, sense of building a whole world. He had that sense. Yadda said this, Yadda says that. he saw himself as building a total, not a system, and Hegel says the term. He was with Kierkegaard rather than with Hegel. But he very consciously saw himself as building a Hashkofa for a generation, and not just for one generation. And he spoke with a sense of authority, which went hand in hand with the inclination to engage in interpretation, exposition, and the spirit of originality, particularly the material which was published in his lifetime. Most of these were published afterwards, I think, are less, something less strident in tone, less magisterial, but the major works which he published in his lifetime, primarily Isha Halacha, The Only Man of Faith, the Kashi Misham. In all of them, there's one kind of another magisterial tone. It's not the same voice. Isha Halacha is very triumphant, a triumphalist in its tone, sense of the ability to progress, succeed, etc. There's much hesitation in Lonely Man of Faith. But in Lonely Man of Faith, a sense that he was a master dealing with the material, telling you how to think and what to think, was very clear. Part of it has to do with the point with his personality, part of it has to do with the point at which he arrived historically. I once asked the Balabas in Boston, who learned in Raden, and he became the head of the Chevrul Shas in Boston, a businessman, but a little bit there. And I asked him, told me before the Rav came to America, what was the element of Machshava, the predominant Machshava? His answer to me was clear and unequivocal. Father of Rav's Kuman in America, but in America, Golden Shigitrach. People didn't address these issues, didn't think about them. By and large, I'm not very familiar with that material either, but by and large, if you look at the material that you had before, what do you have? Books of sermons, popular religion, desperate attempts to market Yiddishkeit as providing success, peace of mind, etc., etc. Well, you have someone with scope and force and vigor. Coming to the fore in the desert, maybe gave one the right to have a more prophetic tone. Even though maybe Spitzer was not prophetic, but maybe Spitzer was. And certainly very magisterial. People like myself, apart from the infinite distance, quality of our respective abilities and capacities, but we come and begin to function within a world which has certain parameters. With certain ideas, a current coin, certain issues, certain problems. And then we talk, we write, we discuss, and we lecture, and we convene within the context of a universe of discourse which has been molded, within which you operate. I don't say that every single issue that comes up, first question you ask yourself is, what would Allah say? But somewhere in the background, probably at some point, you'll encounter it. I go to the Orthodox Four Manual in America. And I'm a fairly, let's say dominant, but a fairly significant figure over there. Every year, whatever the topic is, at some point, either someone's lecturing, one of the lectures is what the author said about this topic, or it's going to come up some other way. I have no pretensions that that's the way I'm regarded or should be regarded. And in that respect, seems to you to be more complex. It's something a little more nuanced. But it's more nuanced because the raw materials were put on the table by the Rav. Then you can work with it one direction, another direction. It's a major sensitivity, probably with less of an assertive tone than I think the Rav had. Whether this is in any way characteristic of the Neo-Kantians, I don't know. Yes?
Earlier in the year in West Orange, Rabbi mentioned about having Abba for Eretz Yisrael, mentioned that the reason behind it would be the obvious Kedusha that it has. In light of the Rav's idea that Kedusha is something which there's a certain human element which is put in, I just have a hard time understanding what exactly the Kedusha is and then what does it mean to have a love for that Kedusha, particularly in light of the fact that there's just a human dimension also.
Well, here you're dealing with issues again on a shkofer at a basic level. What the source of the Kedusha is. And when I say the source, it'll be in two respects. From whom it came and what its basis is. Whom it came, here you have the more mystical and metaphysical school, thinks that Kedusha is antecedent to history, prehistoric, stamped upon Eretz Yisrael by the Ben Shulam, and inherent and imminent within every stone, within every tree, as you, without the Shabbos, of Kedushas Zman, the Ibreza speaks of where Rabbi Yoshua Kaddish said that he poured, as it were, Kedusha into the day, qualitatively making it a different kind of time, quality time in the original sense. Something of the same, but he got the place. From that point of view, what people did here is that we made it Kaddish. Maybe what they did, the kind of lives that they led were influenced by the Kedusha, but they're not the source of it. There's another question, not who made it Kaddish, but in what does the Kedusha subsist? What does it consist of? And here again, you have two schools, one which is probably more inclined to be moral than ethical, and combined the first problem, more historical in nature, and the other, which is more like to be metaphysical. Kedusha comes from the Ben Shalom, that Kedusha has to do with the bond, the link to the Ben Shalom. This is my Shechina. This, because what Gemara Yume is the point of departure of the Bri as a whole, that's the basic Kaddish. Now, other people turned off by that. If they're not turned off, don't think that's where Kedusha is coming from. They think Kedusha comes from, as you see, it's insofar as you deal with something which is sacral, it comes from sanctity. Sanctity is a human action. People who speak in this vein, Kedusha has to do about Yisrael with a stamp that was imprinted upon it by what people did with Yisrael. And that itself, what attracts you to Yisrael, what should attract Yisrael, can appear at different levels. The Medrash of Lech Lecha near the beginning, says, why was the woman attracted to Yisrael? So, of course, if you're very firm about these matters, you say, what do you mean? He smelled the Kedusha. Every stone had it. But the Medrash says that he found that the people who lived outside Ram Naraim wanted to having a good time, a lot of fun, a very fun-oriented society, אוכלים, שותים ופוחזים, סיבריטיק, הידניסטיק, never worked. Came to Sulman the Tzer, came to Board of Arts Israel, here he sees country where people are חורשים משעת חרישה, זורים משעת זריעה, מהדרים משעת עידור, etc., etc. And then the Mendel says, we got Rav Naraim, he said, לא יהיה חלקי עם ארץ הזאת, came to Arts Israel, he said, these are people, hardworking people, the work ethic to be proud of, יהיה חלקי עם ארץ הזאת. And that's what the Medrash says. But some people who feel that's belittling, that's kesef katan, that you could find maybe in Victorian England too. Admittedly, if you're basing it something like this, maybe temporary. Maybe one century, that's what they did in Eretz Yisrael. The next century, they did the reverse. Look at the great empires of classical antiquity. Rome started like Eretz Yisrael, working very hard. They ended up with one Roman circus after the other. But there are other elements which can give certain Kedushin to Eretz Yisrael. And this is the existence of the Avos. Not what the Avos found when they came to Eretz Yisrael, but what they infused into Eretz Yisrael. Avos Hashem, a level of Ava, of Hira. And that presence, once it fused into the country, was part of its history, part of its past, part of its present, part of its future. And that's where Kedusha comes from, people, and from the kind of lives that certain people led. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that these are antithetical views, they're very different views. One can conceivably assume that Kedusha is the interface and the interaction of two different elements. You ask about Avos Eretz Yisrael. The Ava has to do partly with the religious dimension I mentioned before. If you were told that this is a country, a land within which the imminent presence of Shekhinah is felt particularly, that presumably should affect how you respond, relate to being here, living here. Be it in terms of even one's mundane activity, or be it as the Ramban particularly held, for Kiyum HaMitzvah Yis Hashem. He thought that Kiyum HaMitzvah was all a preparation for getting to Eretz Yisrael, which I find very difficult to assume. I certainly can assume that, qualitatively speaking, Kiyum HaMitzvah is different than Lizkus HaAretz. To have Avos Eretz Yisrael is to have Ava for what this country has been in the past, Ava for what it's going to be in the future. Tanakh, you open up a Tanakh, talks about Achit HaYamim. No mention of the Achit HaYamim, the Goyim all going to flock to New York or to San Francisco. But come to Yerushalayim. That's what Yeshayahu talks about, that's what Micha talks about. And that's part of the eschatological vision that we have. To the extent one identifies with that, not only in political terms, but first and foremost in moral and ethical terms. And if you even speak of what Achisim are going to be all about, it's more than ethical perfection more than anything else, a religious perfection. So you bound various time frames and with a set of values. And first and foremost, you bound with the Mishnah who is here. Many people, of course, would think that the notion of the Mishnah is here and there primitive. But we don't think so. We think in Dimalech HaLaz Kvayday, but there was more access certain times, certain places than others. Especially Mr. Kubi Tokarov speaks of times, but Dimatsovi Tokarov is also, in a sense, place. as all of that vein speak very clearly. Most called the Gemara Tainis. Gemara says that the whole world, Ben Shleilim is Mashke through Malachim, through agents. Other countries, Shalech, the Shalech, that's Israel, direct involvement. That's a variation, of course, of the Ramban's perception of human history in general. In a distinct sense, is more Ashgacha, more direct involvement, engagement. Although it's a certain plane, of course, there's a supervision and direction and a universal and cosmic plane as well. Does this mean that we should be in love with every chief politician or every lawyer gets murdered? That's the definition. Part of Avraham's soil has to be loving the people who live there. Someone has to be loving as the soil, despite the people who live there.
In regards to the conversion issue of lay, aside from the politics, of course, I'm having a hard time grappling with the Rabbanim of ours that are supposedly opposed to the Haredi position. What is the most minimalist shita of the definition of Kabbalah's all mitzvahs, and how will that solve the problem of the hundreds of thousands of people in the country whose problem has to be solved?
I don't know what the least minimalist position is. I assume it's not identical with the maximalist position. But what it is, I couldn't tell for certain. I asked Shlomo Zalman this question once. I couldn't get a clear answer out of him. What I saw was that I began to talk to him about the reforming conservatives in America, and I couldn't perceive the scope or the nature of the issue. He said, what do you mean? I go, me, I'm coming up with you. I said to him, but these are not our people. These are people who are not ours. These come from other camps. And he didn't succeed in getting a clear answer about it. There are certain modes of dealing with it. What do you think about Maxwell's position? Someone told me the other day that he understands that the instructions which Rabbi Yoshua was given to people who were God for him, with his imprimatur, came in with God, a woman who will not commit herself to coming here. I was told some years back that in London that's actually what they do. And if one assumes that in advance every single needs to be accepted a priori and be spelled out, whatever if you get around. I don't think that we can mortgage our spiritual future, the future of Galus in general, in order to solve the current problem. They said the Chayim are right. But how far to go in that direction? Now look at some recognition once a person is within the system, certain things that should be ikrim, less so. Kalos and Chmuris. If we say we skalk with Chmura, so in terms of encouraging you or demanding of you, and not only because the Mishnah says you don't know what's Kal, what's Chmur. Even if you knew, which is Kal, this Kal is not some of the directive you got from the boss. Kal is what you hear from the bench later. That should certainly be the case. But does that translate? Everything which you would like your people around you to do, what you would like the community to do, what you would like children to do. Every single detail there serves as a barrier to admission to the fold. That I think is less clear. My prayer speaks to the community of Seferim, but it's not clear whether that's Chatkila B'Dieved. It's also not clear whether that's for Gerus or for some other status, which you mentioned over there, a number of Chaverus, those. I think to some extent, some of the people in the Tilumi community maybe not consciously so, but at least unwittingly, going out of their way to spread some confusion and put some sand in the eyes of any other people. If one would take the position that Yeos doesn't require Kabbalah's visas altogether, and if people take that position, the Bach thought that I'm held that way, something to retwell that way, and number chubis, that vein, or it's enough, they just accept some kind of ethical imperatives, you would have aim, it's lucky. One thing's those terms, then of course you could be mechanical with many people. But those days, certainly the Bach's shita is very much of that. That's Yochid Mamish, that's Miut, to the least. And then the question, what are the Ikrim, what are the Tefillah? My Yavamis describes that you have to tell them, Islam is God's Chaburis, and the Rambam has given his theological orientation, you have to tell them also, Ikri Adas, Isur Abit Zara, and Yichud Hashem. He doesn't know about the whole Yud-Gimel-Ikim. He doesn't say that they don't need to accept the Yud-Gimel-Ikim. You don't discuss it with him. Doesn't describe it. Very satisfied with these most basic points. What's worked up, many people within the Yud-Gimel community, myself included, apart from the issue per se, with regard to which I think one needs to take a very serious approach with the tactics that have been employed. I think the snow job which that community has been doing against Rav Drukman is beneath any ethical or moral standard, beneath any halachic standard. I think the Dayanim who are spreading all kinds of innuendos, I think they're 10 times more puzzled than the Rav Drukman himself. Terrible, terrible. Hashem, it's frightful. But that's another issue. Okay, well.